If you haven't already, explore the many ways to connect with our show. Watch full uncut conversations on YouTube, gain AIA-approved continuing education credits through Arcademy, and make sure to check us out and follow us on social media at Detailed Podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
There was this studio tour, East Austin Studio Tour, which is now a broader Austin citywide studio tour where all these artists and makers would open their spaces up. And a lot of these spaces were warehouses similar to the one we were looking at the beginning of this project. And so there's already this culture and community around like inviting the public in into these spaces. And so that was really a big driver for, you know, trying to make the front of this building and that plaza space feel super inviting and flexible for the community. And so there were a lot of what ifs and decisions that sort of just rolled into, making something that turned out to be an inside out office building in a way.
It's kind of funny too. Like, if you think about it, typically an office building, and especially of this kind of scale, they tend to be maybe a little more suburban. And so your landscape is outside, like around the building. But considering, again, our constraints and trying to work within this existing footprint, not being able to totally affect the rest of the site, we kind of brought the landscape into the middle. So that's another sort of take on the inside out nature of this project.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, Senior Specification Writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guests today are Travis Albrecht, Studio Director and Principal, and Michael Waddell, Senior Associate Design Director at Gensler in their Austin, Texas office. Travis is a highly sought-after resource within the firm for his design vision and expertise in sustainable design and planning. He has experience with a wide range of project types, from commercial office buildings and mixed-use developments to educational spaces and master planning. He is knowledgeable regarding all phases of a project, from conceptual design to detailing and construction administration. Travis is also involved in strategic planning and thought leadership in Gensler's office on topics including digital design, design resilience, and design purpose. Since joining Gensler in 2011, Michael has developed a research-driven approach to each of his projects, centered on user experience and creating transformational places. Michael's focus is on the planning and design of mixed-use projects, bringing the same user-centric approach with a focus on experience at a human scale. Michael is passionate about the built environment and the role placemaking plays in our lives. His current focus is on maximizing walkability in our communities and prioritizing people in the planning and design process. The project we're talking about today is the 5th and Tillery office building in Austin, Texas. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. At the intersection between the residential area of East Austin and its industrial past, 5th and Tillery begins as a problem of section and envelope rather than style. The project revitalizes a warehouse with strong bones and a history of housing creative spaces and workshops.
So 5th and Tillery, it's at a really interesting spot of East Austin. It's you know, along Fifth Street, there's a whole lot of older industrial buildings. And so this building in particular was, I believe, and Travis, correct me, I think it was like a 200 foot by 375 foot footprint, really like a one story. The original warehouse is a one story Butler building. It was not in great condition, but it, like a lot of old buildings, you could say it had good bones. It had, you know, a good solid foundation, something to start with. But it was, you know, really this warehouse that had been, you know, used in different ways over the years as creative space, studios, wood shops. And when we started taking a look at it, it was in the process of some light renovations and really trying to reimagine its next life as a place for creatives in the neighborhood. But for all intents and purposes, it was the site when we got it was almost, I don't know, 98% impervious cover, 99% impervious cover is a whole lot of paving and a gigantic warehouse.
Fifth and Tillery demonstrates how adaptive reuse can be an exercise in precision, recomposing an inherited site into a high-performance workplace that aligns program, climate, and urban context.
On a lot of these projects, they live for years before they become real projects. And you've got a client and they say, hey, I've got this piece of property. I'm thinking about doing this on it. Can, you know, we kick around some ideas on it? And so when we first started talking to our client about it, he wanted us to, you know, basically say, like, how do we create a great space for creatives to come together on this site? You know, I want to try to work with what we have and see what we can do. And the initial design studies on the project, you know, looked at how do we work with the existing bent frames and, you know, are we adding skylights and light wells to this giant footprint? When you would go in that existing building, it was dark, it was cavernous, it was oppressive, it was not somewhere you wanted to be. It only had small windows on one side of the building. And we really worked through a range of different design schemes in the beginning and concepts where we were scabbing on structure to create mezzanines and, you know, starting to carve in light wells. And we sort of reached a point in the creative process working through this with the client where it wasn't doing enough to create enough of a place or enough of that environment we were looking to create. And so at a certain point, we had to abandon the existing steel bent frame and really look at it as adaptive reuse within the framework of the site. And so the city of Austin has different entitlement processes that, you know, sort of scrutinize projects at different levels. And so being able to utilize the existing foundation and sort of framework to the site has sort of locked us into a box where it was like, kind of like, hey, Genzer, we can give you this box to play within. And so that was really that, you know, 4 foot foundation footprint of the building. And then within that, we looked at, well, how do we weave in a new structure into this foundation, work around sort of the existing spaghetti that exists within that ground plane, and try to create a tremendous experience sort of within that framework of kind of like site-wide adaptive reuse. But in the end, sort of through the explorations, we had to part ways with some of the existing structure and sort of take an approach of, you know, surgically inserting a new grid of structure into this existing warehouse and almost rebuilding from that existing slab up to I think, create something that got to the level of vision and experience of what we were trying to create on site.
And I think that Michael used the right phrase here, sort of an adaptive reuse of the site and not necessarily of the building vertical structure itself. So still having to stick with a lot of the infrastructure, you know, utilities, drainage patterns, all that kind of stuff. And then even building height, right? Like we had to match the existing building heights. And I think that also goes to what's interesting from adaptive reuse, and that as a strategy is it kind of keeps the same form and shape and envelope that has existed for a long time in this neighborhood. And I think that was also another important thing about the site itself is it's, as Michael described, like most of Fifth Street from downtown to where this building hits is old warehouse buildings. But then this is really at that line where then it transitions to actually a neighborhood. And so this building kind of sits on that line. So we were also trying to be mindful of the scale of the project, that it didn't exceed what had existed for a long time to overwhelm, you know, the adjacent neighborhood. So those are all important factors too in kind of how we approach things and kept within, you know, the existing limits, right?
The project's program and site were contradictory, creating a vibrant space that encapsulates well-being, sustainability, and a connection to nature on a site with limited square footage and in such disrepair.
Going back to that first conversation with the client, you know, we met out on site like, you know, architects and clients do, and you're sort of looking around and trying to get the lay of the land. And yeah, sort of the discussion was the client wanted to create a special place to bring creatives together. And it was a little bit of an open-ended prompt of like, how do we do this? How do we create a great place sort of within this? We're stuck with this foundation and this site. We can't orient the building in a different way. We're kind of limited on how we approach this thing, but how do we create a great experience and great building? And then of course there's, you know, every project has a business case, and there was, you know, the idea of trying to add square footage, add multiple levels, be able to get more tenants within the building. But it was really this prompt, and you know, the client I think was told us, and we had worked with them before, that they wanted to take some risk and really push what we could do from a design perspective. And it's interesting that, you know, there's sort of the business case prompt, and then the client sort of had this like a little bit of an idea he had been kicking around, and he's like, I'm not sure where this is going to go, but like, what if the building feels like walking into a forest? What if there's sort of this warmth and sort of Nordic feeling to this? You know, we're standing on this site that, again, is like 99% impervious cover. The 1% is probably like weeds coming through the asphalt on this site. And we're like, you know, this is rough. Like, we're trying to design for well-being here, and we've got this site that's just all paving. I mean, it was a truck yard before. And just thinking about like, how do we, if we're really limited to the footprint of this warehouse, how do we start to solve for some of these well-being issues and introduce biophilia and landscape into the project? And so it was this really interesting process where it's like, there's a business case, there's sort of a loose vision of what the experience might feel like. And then incrementally along the way, like everything was really a question of like, how do we do more with what we have with the end user in mind? And what was super fun about this was just like, well, we need daylight. How do we do that? And then, so all these sort of decisions around well-being and performance sort of led to other opportunities, and the whole sort of thing just sort of evolved naturally through that process.
It's amazing transformation, right? And so it's not enough, like you can transform a site and a project in a lot of different ways, right? You can add on to it, you can subtract from it, you can do all kinds of things. But I think our goal here, again, to Michael's point, was how does it change the site to the better, right? For both, you know, potentially the site itself, but then also the people who are going to work there day in and day out. And how does it, you know, foster well-being, but how does it foster connectivity and community as well as a building, right? Like some buildings, you just go in, we were talking about this, some buildings you just go in and you hit the elevator and you don't see anybody except the people in your particular office suite, and then you leave and that's it, right? I think because we were sort of designing towards that idea of a creative community, that we wanted the building to respond and play a role in that. So that's, you know, also part of it is it helps be a social connector as well. And that was a big design driver. In addition to like biophilia and daylight, was how does the building facilitate people seeing one another, even though they may not work together, and all those kinds of things.
The project's design retains the full perimeter of the existing warehouse and reorganizes its interior mass into a porous figure ground composition, carving a courtyard from within to recalibrate daylight, circulation, and environmental performance without increasing the building's footprint.
Because we started with a giant, you know, footprint, like I said, when you walked into the warehouse building originally, you couldn't see the other end of it because it was so dark. So really carving the building and creating opportunities for daylight to come in, and then that kind of creating opportunities for vegetation and and all those kinds of things. But the other strategy we talked about was, you know, again, it's people don't often think about it, but it's a passive strategy from a sustainability standpoint as well. Like instead of having a fully enclosed lobby that you have to condition and light and all those kinds of things, you actually approach this building from an open porch and open patio, you know, again, part of that welcoming gesture. But then it's your lobby is outdoors. So there is no indoor space acts as a lobby. And so that's part of turning things inside out. The other was, like I mentioned, all the walkways, all the circulation on each floor between, again, we conceived of it as a multi-tenant building. So the circulation that would otherwise be in a center core building buried inside the center of the building. And again, a space that's really just about transitioning people and has no real value other than that, but you have to spend money conditioning it and lighting it and all the materials that go along with that. So this, you know, really turned that inside out. And because we wanted to carve the courtyard from a daylight perspective, that also became the opportunity to center the circulation around that. It also, you know, kind of, again, to that point, instead of you walking down a corridor on your floor where your suite is, you're walking outside and you're seeing other tenants circulate as well. So it becomes that visual connector and social connector. So that's why it kind of flips your typical center core office building inside out.
I think what was really exciting about how that sort of came to be was it was probably a couple months of like what ifs that sort of led to this configuration. And it all really started with a bunch of daylight studies. And we were looking at skylights and light wells. I mean, I think at some point the thing looked like a giant donut with two holes in it. And, you know, there was sort of like, you know, trying to solve this sort of puzzle of how do you work within this giant footprint and create a great experience. And it was like, well, what if we just made this 280-foot bars with a central courtyard? And that's a kind of ideal width for double-sided daylighting in an office environment. And then it was sort of this idea of, well, then if we do that, how does our core work? Well, what if our core work sort of creates this entry plaza? And it's like, well, that's an interesting idea, but it's Texas, it's hot. And we're like, well, this building's oriented in this way where it's actually like really catching the predominant breezes from the southeast. And so how do we really start to shape this in a way to carry that into the space? And then we were working with Cameron Campbell, landscape architect, on the project. And it's like, well, what if we bring in, you know, a grove of trees across the front of this courtyard and then start to bring that landscaping down inside of it? And then we're like, well, we need this soil depth to create this. And we're like, well, what if we start redirecting a lot of the roof stormwater and make that central landscaping a rain garden and really improve the quality of how the site impacts the greater neighborhood with, you know, 99% impervious cover? And so, you know, incrementally, we just kept making these decisions. I mean, there was no sort of like, this is what it should be. It was, we need all these corridors and connections. And so, you know, what if we made a living room on the second floor? So the walkways sort of create this broader connection where, you know, you sort of get this lobby element on the second floor. And then even, you know, we've got this great plaza space, and community was a huge part of this. And so that monumental stair going up from the plaza to the second level also doubles as a space for community events. And one thing I just wanted to touch on in the story of this project is that the neighborhood and context was extremely important. I know, Travis, I think you used to have a maker shop over on the east side. And then I've lived in East Austin pretty much from graduating University of Texas here in Austin. And there was this studio tour, East Austin Studio Tour, which is now a broader Austin citywide studio tour where all these artists and makers would open their spaces up. And a lot of these spaces were warehouses similar to the one we were looking at the beginning of this project. And so there's already this culture and community around like inviting the public in into these spaces. And so that was really a big driver for, you know, trying to make the front of this building and that plaza space feel super inviting and flexible for the community. And so there were a lot of what ifs that's, and decisions that sort of just rolled into, you know, making something that turned out to be an inside out office building in a way.
It's kind of funny too. Like if you think about it, typically an office building, and especially of this kind of scale, they tend to be maybe a little more suburban. And so your landscape is outside, like around the building. But considering, again, our constraints and trying to work within this existing footprint, not being able to totally affect the rest of the site, we kind of brought the landscape into the middle. So that's another sort of take on the inside out nature of this project.
For the client, Cap Metro, the building anchors an expanding campus adjacent to existing facilities, offering a workplace that expresses their sustainability mission through form, section, and material.
There's some adjacencies at play. So right next door to Fifth and Tillery is actually one of their bus yards. And then a little bit further down Fifth Street is actually Cap Metro's headquarters. So strategically, it's adjacent, you know, so it's nice to have that kind of more campus feel for them. But I think at a larger picture, they were really interested in this building also because of all of its sustainability, that it's a very sustainable forward project, you know, not so like in your face, and but that it's like integral to the design and the ethos of the project. And I think as Cap Metro, they are of that same mindset. So it kind of fit their own mission and kind of their own values. And I think that's what's been important. We've got some interesting feedback that, you know, they've got another office building down the street, like their headquarters, and now they have a group working in this building. And apparently there's some jealousy with people who still have to work in the original building instead of in Fifth and Tillery. So
I was just going to ask, who's fighting over who gets to work in the new building and who gets to work in the old one? That doesn't surprise me at all.
I think also, and what Michael was touching on before about the way we created this project to have an open feeling and that community, that sense of connection to community, that was another value that I know Cap Metro is keyed in on. And so again, it's interesting that a building, you don't often think about it, but sometimes a building can represent values just as much as anything else. So.
To prepare the site for all of the biophilic systems, soil depth, and stormwater drainage inherent to the design, the foundation required cutting a massive hole in the original slabs.
I think it's quite a few challenges of understanding how to build something that's never been built like this before. You know, it's not, there's no set of instructions. So you're trying to approach this from so many different perspectives.
This is Cameron Campbell, president of Campbell Landscape Architecture.
Making sure it's safe, it doesn't flood, that this was an existing adaptive reuse project, like I mentioned. So the foundation of the existing building, we basically cut a giant hole out, we turned it down, and we lined it and created a permeable soil profile that was captured also the sub-drainage, and making sure that we weren't introducing water into a foundation that would otherwise cause issues down the road. And so lots of kind of geotechnical coordination and challenges as well to make this function. We couldn't just cut a hole and put some plants in and call it a day. The slabs were flat because it was a foundation of a conditioned space. And so we had to do some topping slabs and drain everything properly and work with lots of finished floor kind of door jam conditions along that linear frontage on both sides.
I think getting the soil depth was a challenge. And so working with this existing slab, obviously there's, you know, a lot of rebar and foundation and things we had to worry about. And structurally, we got a big rig up there and drilled piers. And so all the new structure is, you know, down deep below the foundations are deep below the existing slab. But then, I mean, they were just out there saw cutting out kind of the footprint of this rain garden, central landscaping court, and clearing everything out and then building a bathtub and, you know, filling it up with the right materials to filter the stormwater out and let the plants thrive. So it was a real collaboration with Cameron and his team to get that right and get that experience right. But it was a little bit of, you just kind of got to cut into the concrete, see what you're working with, and then make it happen.
punched openings along east and west facades balance solar gain with visual porosity, while integrated louvers pull filtered air across planted edges where landscape and breezes act as passive scrubbers. The envelope thickens where it must perform, thins where it can invite light, and remains economical through a disciplined module that respects the original structure.
During the design process, there was a lot of daylight modeling and studying of views. I think one of the challenges of the site was that the existing warehouse had really long west and east facing facades. The courtyard, the shorter end of the building, faces south and then the north side as well. And so we were dealing with an orientation that wasn't great. And so doing the daylight studies, it sort of led to this strategy of right-sizing punched openings on the western and eastern facades to understand, you know, we need daylight, but actually not that much. And then where we were on the courtyard and we had natural shading from the walkways and views of nature, we did the floor-to-ceiling glass, or I think it's floor-to-10-feet-tall glass, not quite ceiling, well, depending if you put one in. And so, you know, where we were well shaded, you know, and had great views of nature, trying to maximize those views. Then even back to the story of the site, the property that's just north of this used to be a place called Utility Research Garden. And it was a landscape design and installation firm. And they had planted a lot of great trees of amazing colors. And so that whole north-facing facade is all continuous glass window wall to really capture those views of that adjacent side. And then, of course, we're not getting a lot of direct solar load on that facade either. So I think there was a lot of attention paid to the fenestration strategies where we had shading or not shading. And even on the front plaza where we've got, you know, some pretty tall window wall in that section, we extended the PV array from the roof to create a trellis that provided shading for that space and for that glazing as well. And so really just trying to be mindful about the performance of the envelope in that way. The other thing that was just challenging from a design perspective, and we dug our own hole on this one, is that most, you know, projects, you're going through the economics or the pro forma of a project. And on commercial projects especially, you get people looking at your ratio of building envelope to floor area and all these kind of metrics that they judge your efficiencies on. And you know, for this client and this project, design and experience was the number one priority. But in a way, by carving this courtyard through the site and not doing like light wells or skylights or floor cutouts or some of the other strategies we had looked at, we added a lot of building envelope that you wouldn't have in kind of a different configuration. And so again, it was really important to shade that envelope that we added in a thoughtful way. But then we had to execute the envelope economically as well. And so it's, you know, pretty much a straightforward metal panel rain screen wall assembly and a window wall system. So something that could be economical and really, I think, achieve the goals of the project without, you know, we weren't going in and trying to pitch a zinc cladding system for something. I mean, it would have felt out of character with the neighborhood and definitely would have made this thing never get built. So we had to be really mindful of those decisions to really get the project out of the ground.
The roofing system houses many of the sustainable efforts, including rain-catching cisterns and the extensive solar array.
The square footage of the roof and the sizing of the cisterns, we've had situations where the rain is like, you know, overflowed and it's all functioned properly, but I think it would have been better if we could have stored even more water, but that takes up more square footage and cost to the project. So I think we struck a good balance of capture to reuse, and I think, you know, learning from it for future projects, I would say that, you know, there's always an opportunity to store more water for reuse, but I think it turned out just great as it was.
I believe the project's primarily a TPO roof system, and I believe the PVs are just, you know, up on dunnage arrays. And you know, that PV system was really interesting because that was another one where we were just looking at views of the project during design and seeing this, huge roof area, and Austin has requirements for like solar ready for roof. Like when you design a project, you have to dedicate a portion of your roof for future PVs. And we got the solar consultant on board to start looking at it and crunching the numbers, and the payback period was pretty quick on it. And so it's really just one of those things that, you know, evolved from that. But in, you know, the roof system, a lot of the commercial systems are pretty typical. We didn't have to do anything special in terms of beefing things up for the PV array, besides just knowing the weight of it and making sure it all transferred down to the foundations.
The great thing about that solar array is ultimately, you know, it's a combination, like we said, of really a feature. So providing kind of that canopy feature at the entry, but then just ballasted panels on dunnage on the main roof. But overall, it offsets about 75% of the electrical demand for the building. So that was really great to see the client make that investment. But again, it's got a return, so it makes sense.
A hybrid timber frame is threaded through the existing shell, introducing a low-carbon structural system that registers warmth against the warehouse's concrete and steel.
Really primarily focusing on the core and shell, but I think getting back to the structural idea of the building, it really leads to some really interesting space and warmth within the building. And so going back to this idea of drilling piers in the slab, the columns that went up were basically continuous columns that went from the foundation all the way to supporting the roof structure. So those 10-inch round steel columns are continuous. And then there was, you know, really this idea of, you know, how do we articulate the connections of the glue lam beams to that and sort of create these, you know, seats that are expressed, and really thinking through like how does this sort of visual repetition of these detailings and connections really create that force like feel within the space and bring that warmth into it. And so as you know, we weren't doing the interior design, but I think really the, you know, having that hybrid timber structure and that warmth come from outside, it's, you know, cantilevers out and supports the balconies, those walkways around the building as well, and then bring that in, you know, it does a couple of things. It, you know, adds a ton of warmth to the space. It connects the view or sort of the sight line from inside and out. I mean, it really makes it a, you know, a much different space than when you have a concrete grid at 30 feet on center, you know, sort of a different experience. And, you know, this was also designed on a typical steel grid as well. I mean, we had to go on a grid that was maneuverable around the existing structure so that we didn't have too much heartbreak drilling into the concrete, getting it to work. But it's a 25-foot grid for the building. But I think some of those elements, really just trying to pay attention to the detailing of this and how that works its way as this visual array across the building, like impacted kind of the quality and nature of that interior space.
The wood's definitely a game changer.
Yeah, I think it creates, I mean, even though we're not, you know, we weren't designing the interior space, I think because of the way we did end up designing the structural system and even the floor, right? The floor is a long span metal deck, so it eliminates the need for secondary structure. So really those glue lam beams are the primary horizontal structure, and those become the expression in the space, and then it's very clean after that. So I think it creates an environment for tenants that they don't have to work as hard to create something interesting and create an interesting space, right? That it kind of is given to them, and then they can lay out rooms and other spaces as they need. But the quality of the interior is, as I would call it, elevated than yeah. Typically you get a bunch of gray concrete or, you know, steel that you're trying to cover up because it's messy and, you know, doesn't look all that appealing, or you try to paint it black, right? Make it go away. So I think it contributes definitely to the interior.
Sustainability is baked into the project as an organizing principle, weaving elements into the inside-out design. The photovoltaic canopy generates power while casting shade over outdoor workspaces. A rain garden and slender runnel guide stormwater through the site, creating a cooling microclimate and habitat for birds and pollinators.
One thing we we have realized over time, and I think we were doing it consciously in some ways and subconsciously in others, but really the story for this project for me is creating co-benefits to the strategies you're using. So not just thinking of sustainability strategies as tackling one issue at a time, but using those strategies to do multiple things. So the most visible example is the solar array, right? Like we're collecting the, you know, sun and turning it into energy for the building, but that solar array becomes a shading feature for the spaces below. And so it helps cool the environment. Again, Texas is hot and we love the sun, but we don't like to linger under the sun. So as much as you can provide shade, all the better. And so that was one example. The other we kind of talked about at the beginning where, you know, we carved this courtyard and that was about creating more daylight into the interior spaces. But that also became where we focused a lot of our greenery and biophilia and allowing, you know, people to see and experience nature while they're in their office. But then it also became stormwater management, right? So we, that courtyard and those planting areas are rain gardens. And so they help filter the stormwater runoff. That was also, you know, where we created a significant water feature, right? So there's a runnel that carries recycled water that's captured from the roof. So we've got a bunch of cisterns that capture rainwater from the roof. And then that helps to provide water for irrigation for the planting, but then it also runs that runnel. And so that runnel goes all the way through the courtyard and helps cool the space too. So it provides, you know, that sound of water, which is also about wellness, but then it's also a cooling factor. So it creates a microclimate. So it's all those, you know, great co-benefits that all come together, I think, really well in this project and really help illustrate the power, in my perspective, of integrating sustainability into your design and not just making it, you know, part of a checklist or something that a client asks you to add on, you know, after you've already designed the project.
Of all the components contained within this project, managing the stormwater practically while improving the foundation presented a standout design hurdle.
One of the biggest things was really how to deal with stormwater and water, because again, from its existing condition, it was one building that covered the whole footprint, you know, of it. And so, of course, all the water gets directed to the side from the roof, you know, down to downspouts and all that kind of fun stuff. The challenge we created for ourselves is we cut a big hole in it. And now we've got to get water from the inside out, right? So that was kind of one of those challenges from the site perspective. But I think, again, the way we approached it was that courtyard acts as a rain garden. And so it's able to collect the stormwater from the roof and from the rain, you know, falling within the courtyard. And it really treats that water before, you know, then it gets discharged. So that was, again, part of that sustainability strategy, but then just a practical matter of getting water out from the middle of the building.
The construction phase offered several opportunities for creativity, particularly what valuable materials reveal themselves in adaptive reuse.
Going back to sort of this, you know, design build spirit that, you know, I think some of the elements of this project had, I think there were probably less challenges and more, I think, opportunities that came out of the construction process. And so, you know, for our client, this was their first building to integrate timber with. It had been something that they were really interested in. And, you know, all these beautiful Doug fir glue lamps came from Rosboro. And, you know, they were site fabricated as well. And, you know, just, you know, the challenges of working with timber at a certain point, they're like giant 2x4s. And, you know, we'd be out there doing CA and, you know, there were definitely a couple structural things that we had to work through or intersections and joints that weren't thought out. But there are also a lot of opportunities. Like we were out there with Cameron Campbell, the landscape architect, and there's just sitting on the side of the parking lot is this stack of discarded glue lamps just kind of in this pile. And Cameron's looking at him and we're like, man, these are really beautiful pieces of wood, but you know, are these just going to be recycled? Like what's happening with it? And we're like, can we use these? And they're like, sure, we're not planning to do anything with them. And so, you know, all those benches through the landscaping on the ground level were just, we changed the landscape design because we were out there watching them put the structure up. And there were just all these cuts from, you know, the fabric on-site fabrication process that we were able to reuse and integrate into the story. But, you know, I think obviously just, you know, probably the biggest challenges were just some of the details in terms of bringing timber and steel together and some of the intersections, but no big surprises or things that I remember losing sleep over.
That is a good example. And I've done quite a bit of adaptive reuse in my career. And one of the things I tell most people about it is like, there are challenges because you're working with existing conditions, but really, if you do approach them as opportunities, you'll find a lot more satisfaction in the end. Like there are always those just like things that just really don't work that you got to work around. But for us, staying true to your design, but having that flexibility that when you run into something unexpected, that you find the value in it, right? Because it's off cuts from glue lamp become beautiful benches and a landscape. Sometimes it's old machinery that gets pulled out and that becomes features in a landscape, or you dig into something and you find something that you weren't expecting and you can, you know, either recycle it or reuse it in some other way. So I think for adaptive reuse projects, that's always how we try to approach it, is that those difficult moments can often be some of the most interesting features of a project.
The project's design strategies converge into a co-benefit approach where every element serves more than one purpose. Shade becomes energy, water becomes cooling, and circulation becomes social space, all a particular highlight for Cameron.
All of these systems working harmoniously to create this just beautiful space is what, you know, you experience. You kind of, when you get there and you arrive and you go up these steps and the runnels like flowing and recirculating, I think it's two things for me, aside from the systems. It's the repetition of materiality, the glue laminate beams of the architecture that kind of terrace down from floor to floor and then land in the landscape as benches. So you get this visual rhythm upon arrival and for use, but also the trees that we planted, bald cypress and sycamores, trees that grow in these kind of riparian little slot canyons of Central Texas, watching them grow and reach up through the various levels with the bridges coming across, it really creates this, you know, beautiful green element that not only the ground level, you know, tenants can experience. It's the level 2 and level 3. And that is, to me, just the beauty of it, is how nature is kind of growing and finding its way through and adapting, or been designed to thrive in this little microclimate that we created. And so I think it's all fronts of architecture complementing the landscape and working, you know, harmoniously for the result that we see today.
By working within the footprint of the past, Fifth and Tillery creates new value in ecological richness, human connection, and a resilient model for post-industrial cities. Within the familiar shell of a warehouse, a new kind of workplace emerges, one rooted in memory, sustained by nature, and open to community. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. I was curious what Travis and Michael thought were the most impactful things we can do with our building designs to make the biggest difference in sustainability and adaptive reuse.
We don't build our buildings these days, you know, just to create monuments. I mean, some people do, but for the most part, we're creating buildings for humans, for that human experience. And so I think being mindful of that and how, again, how our buildings impact people's health, people's well-being. And I think that plays into sustainability in a huge way. Like, again, you really, if you walk into a building that's well thought out and well executed from a sustainable materials and indoor air quality and daylight, you know, it's just a different, it has a different effect on you than any other space. So I think if we can, you know, focus our energy on creating buildings that have those qualities and bring that level of joy to people, hopefully, I think that's where it, again, the rubber meets the road. It's not just talking about performance. It's not just talking about, you know, we use this great material or we save this much carbon. Those are all the sort of the outcomes or the outputs of our efforts. But hopefully in the end, it's really about the people that move in and around our buildings and spaces.
Really focusing on the end user and really, you know, there is so much tremendous research around how the built environment impacts people, impacts their health and well-being. I mean, the project we've been talking about is a commercial office building. And when you look at a lot of companies out there, 90%+ of their overhead, their expenses is their people. The well-being and performance of the people that are working for you, part of your organization, part of your community, is heavily impacted by their built environment. And so that was, we talked a lot about a lot of great sustainable strategies, but at the end of the day, most of them were rooted around really measurable, impactful things that make everybody's experience a better thing day in, day out. Daylighting, fresh air, views to nature, and even thinking about that overhead for a company and then absenteeism or drop in performance. I mean, I think creating a great place, you know, just has a tremendous impact on the people that use it. So I think our architecture and our practice is heavily focused on what that experience is, not just as Travis mentioned, we're not out trying to make monuments. We're trying to make, you know, great places that, you know, people love to be in.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Travis and Michael. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
As a designer, as an architect, that the impact is to provide some inspiration or some optimism out in the world, right? So that, you know, we have a whole lot of stresses and other things that we deal with, and the world changes on a dime sometimes. But if you can have a home, you can have a place you work, you can find those spaces that are familiar to you within a city, that they have that quality of optimism, that would be where I hope my impact, you know, starts to land. And it's not just, again, creating monuments in the sky or things of that nature.
You know, I always go back to, you know, you're a first-year architecture student, you're learning about architecture, and you're learning about firmness, commodity, and delight. And I think what the world needs a lot more these days is more delight. I mean, I think we've got enclosure specialists and structural engineers and folks to help us with the other two. But I think, you know, bringing a little bit more magic into our built environment and the unexpected and just places that are just really fun to be in is sort of something that, you know, I think is, you know, core to this project we've been talking about, and, you know, where I'd love to do more good in the world by creating more great environments like that. And then I think, you know, the other part and one of the exciting things, I've worked with Travis for a long time and, you know, love the creative process working with him and others here in our Austin office, is really just, you know, I think the culture of design and collaboration, getting back to that idea of process where Fifth and Tillery is the result of that culture and that process. And so I think Travis and myself as design leaders in our Austin office, that's also something that we're looking to leave behind and continue to build, is build a practice that leads to more architecture that, you know, has real positive benefit for the world. And you know, as Travis mentioned, I think transformation or transformational is a word we like to think about in terms of what we're crafting and how we're impacting our neighborhoods and communities and the people around us.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.